90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, December 20th, 2009. We've got a great show waiting for you. I think you're really going to like it, one we've been planning for quite some time. But before we get to our guest, let's go listen to a little music and then go right into Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Federal Communications Commission heard an update Wednesday on the progress of the National Broadband Plan. Congress mandated the agency complete the plan by February 17th of next year, and public interest groups are worried that it already may be headed down the wrong track. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press, says the outline presented to the FCC lacked policy ideas for encouraging competition among providers.
The outline raised a number of very good policies like universal service for broadband and technology training and computers for low-income communities. But it fundamentally did not answer the question, what do we do about the lack of competition in our broadband markets? What do we do about the fact that consumers have to choose between a local cable company and a local telephone company to get access to the Internet? Further, they didn't answer or even ask the question, how are we going to catch up with the rest of the world and create an infrastructure that is as fast and as inexpensive as the one in Japan or Korea or half of Western Europe?
Free Press has published a public interest guide called Making the National Broadband Plan Work for America. The guide lays out the central questions that the FCC must answer.
The first thing we have to do is recognize and acknowledge that for the last 8 to 10 years, we've been heading in the wrong direction. And the premise of our broadband policy that all we had to do was deregulate and hand over our broadband networks to AT&T and Comcast, that theory is a failure. We don't have competition, we don't have low prices, we don't have world-class speeds, and we don't have a plan about how to fix those things.
Scott says a major policy intervention is needed to get the country back on track.
You know, this is really a key moment in our nation's history where we've decided that broadband is no longer an entertainment service. It's a critical infrastructure like electricity or water or telephone service. And we wouldn't put up with it if you could only get clean water in cities or if there were rolling brownouts across the Midwest because the population density wasn't sufficient. Infrastructure means everybody has access to a very similar service at a similar price. And right now, if you live in New York City, your broadband network is 10 times better than if you live 150 miles west. And that's a fact that the FCC has to grapple with and find an answer for.
To read Making the National Broadband Plan Work for America, go to freepress.net.
In the mobile phone business, long-term contracts combined with hefty early termination fees keep customers from changing providers, even if they are unhappy with the service or move to a location where their phone no longer has coverage. When Verizon doubled its early termination fee from $175 to $350 for users of some of its smartphones last month, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota responded with the Cell Phone Early Termination Fee Transparency and Fairness Act. Joel Kelsey of Consumers Union says that the bill is a common-sense approach to the problem of unfair early termination fees. It would mandate the Federal Communications Commission to review the fee structures and stop the practice of overcharging consumers for their phones.
Senator Klobuchar's bill does two things. It directs what we've long advocated the commission do, which is investigate the justification of early termination fees on all wireless devices and also require carriers to link those fees to the actual cost that's incurred by a consumer ending their lengthy contract early. So if you are signing up for service with a wireless provider and getting a flip phone that probably costs $10 to $15 or maybe $20 for that wireless provider to give you, they can't charge you a $175 early termination fee.
Wireless companies say the discounted price for phones is subsidized by the long-term contracts. Over time, the companies can recover the actual cost of the phones.
It's not so much a subsidy as it is a loan that consumers never see the terms and conditions of, because you're paying back the carrier for that phone over the course of your contract.
The bill would require wireless carriers to prorate their early termination fees for consumers who leave their contracts early, so that the fee would be reduced to zero by the end of the contract.
There's no reason to reach into consumers' pockets and recover the costs of advertising to new customers, deploying their network, and other things. That should be all in the cost of service provided to the customer, not in early termination fees, which really at this point aren't about recovering the discount that consumers get on the phone, but are about erecting large switching barriers that punish consumers for trying to vote with their feet.
For more information, go to hearusnow.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, September 20th, 2009. Our guest today has been with us before, and he's again joining us, Eric Bollert, the award-winning journalist who writes extensively about media and politics, is the author of two books. The most recent book, the one we'll be talking about today, is just off the presses, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He also is the author earlier of the Lapdogs book, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, which we had him on the program to discuss. And he is a senior fellow for Media Matters for America, the Media Watch group, where he writes a weekly column and blogs extensively if you're interested in finding his work. Eric, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
Very much enjoyed your book. I read it right when it came off the press, and I'm glad we were able to get you on the program. There's a lot of stuff I'd like to talk about today, both the book and also your recent columns and sort of what's going on with media and politics today, because it's certainly as lively a beat as ever, to put it mildly, and your columns have been right in the middle of everything. But let's start in, Eric Bollert, with your new book, Bloggers on the Bus. And just in a nutshell, why did you decide to write the book? And if you could boil it down, what would you say your main argument is?
Well, the main argument is how the liberal blogosphere really changed politics and the press, how it gave a voice to a liberal progressive movement in America that was essentially dormant. If we were talking about 2002, 2003, it was dormant within the Democratic Party. It was dormant within our media conversation, our media debate. And I've just been amazed over the years how really the pioneers and the participants, people who had virtually no professional background in politics or journalism, were able to change the landscape of both. And these are people who did it out of sheer frustration. These are people who had sat through the impeachment, sat through the Florida recount, were watching the run-up to the war. And really were just tired of throwing things at the television. So they turned to their laptop, they turned to their PC with no intention of, you know, growing anything larger than just their own little outpost where they could basically sort of keep their sanity day to day. I didn't really think the press, obviously the press had written a lot about the blogosphere, but I didn't think the mainstream press had done a very good job in terms of explaining who these people were and their significance, and because there are great sort of human interest stories behind this grassroots movement. And then also I thought the 2008 campaign would be a great hook to show specifically in sort of case studies how the liberal blogosphere clearly had an impact on the campaign in a way that we hadn't seen before.
Eric Bollert, who are some of the, or what are some of the big names of the liberal blogosphere? And I say this because I know from correspondence and communications with many of our listeners, well, I think a significant percentage, probably a majority, are wired, they're online, sure. They're tuned in. There's a lot of our listeners who really don't pay that much attention to the Internet and probably don't know what you're talking about.
Sure. Well, some of the cornerstones, some of the sites I sort of paid more attention to than others, particularly because they had interesting life stories. Well, obviously, you know, the Huffington Post, which Arianna Huffington created in the spring of 2005, that really gave a national platform it was really a national embrace of the blogger conversation that had been going on. Arianna Huffington came in with a very high profile, a lot more money than any bloggers had ever been associated with, and she really took that whole blogosphere vibe and gave it a national platform, and it was so much more wildly successful than anyone could have imagined. During the 2008 campaign, the Huffington Post doubled the traffic of the Drudge Report, which I don't think liberals or progressives ever thought they would see. But other sort of pioneers or sites like Crooks and Liars, which was founded by John Amato, Fire Dog Lake, which was founded by Jane Hampshire, Digby, who is a very well-known blogger at her site, Hullabaloo, Duncan Black at Eschaton, obviously Daily Coast, which is sort of the perennial powerhouse in terms of hits and readers and things like that. Glenn Greenwald, who started blogging in 2005 and now is associated with Salon. Those are some of the sites that I paid particular attention to, and some of the sites that really I think are sort of consensus in terms of being the real hallmarks of the early Netroots movement.
Now, how many of these sites that you just named or some of the other ones are in a situation where the people who are doing the blogging, who are writing for them, are able to earn a sufficient enough income that they don't have to, you know, have day jobs, so to speak? How large is that chunk of the blogosphere?
It's probably the ones I just mentioned. I mean, they're literally, I would say, 10.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say there are probably maybe 10 people who can do it full-time. Thinking John Aravosa, America Blog, someone like Steve Brennan, who does it for Washington Monthly, Glenn Greenwald does it with Salon, Coast, Daily Coast obviously makes enough money, Duncan makes money, Digby makes money, also has some sort of fellowships, Fire Dog Lake makes money. There's not many, and it's interesting, that is sort of, it's still sort of the downside of this in that even 7, 8, 9 years later, the liberal blogosphere is still really mostly built on passion, long work days, and not much money, not much infrastructure. It really is sort of lots of tape. It's put together that way. The conservative movement has always been much better at spending lots of money to build infrastructure, even though the conservative blogosphere, I think, lags behind the liberal blogosphere. They get much more institutional support. And the liberal blogosphere is sort of a classic example of how progressives either, A, don't have access to that kind of money, or B, are reluctant to spend it on things like this. So it's a little disconcerting in that, I mean, I can see sort of a perfect storm scenario where if everything sort of goes wrong, a lot of these bloggers and their sites could sort of go away. And the other thing you have to think of is just the sheer exhaustion for people who have been doing this 4 or 5 years, posting 7, 8 items a day. I mean, I think Duncan Black at Eschaton, who blogs as Atrios, I mean, obviously some of his items are sometimes literally 11 words long. They're very short. Some of them are paragraph. I mean, I'm sure he's posted a couple hundred thousand items since he started. And at some point you just say, I can't do this anymore. You know, I want to have sort of my life back. I want to take vacations and things like that.
And have health insurance.
Health
a roof.
There's a definite monkey on the back phenomena involved. So that's my long way of saying the good news is this whole grassroots movement was created online. The bad news is there's not a lot of there in terms of real infrastructure underneath it.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, Eric Bowler, is the author of the brand new book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. It has just been published by Free Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Eric Bowler, the number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Eric, based not just on the book, but the comments you made at the top of the show, the blogosphere sort of empowered and gave a tool to the liberal or progressive wing of the Democratic Party that sort of felt alienated both from the party and the mainstream media. Do you think they were successful in way they used that power to actually change the course of politics, not just journalism in 2008?
Oh, in 2008, yeah. Two things. I mean, I think they had the real imprint in 2006. Because if you go back to sort of early 2006, spring of 2006, conventional wisdom was, you know, Democrats could not run as anti-war. It was too risky. The consultants in the D.C. on K Street were handled it. It looked like it was going to be another classic case of Democrats essentially punting on national security, very timidly talking about the war. And I think it was the liberal blogosphere that created this conversation, a national conversation. They were able to get some candidates out front really taking an anti-war position. They were able to raise money for candidates to show them that there was a backing. And by fall of 2006, enough other things had happened that Democrats, lots of Democrats, were clearly running as anti-war candidates. And the success was obvious at the ballot box. In 2008, I think it's interesting in that the things had gone so badly for the Bush administration that, yeah, I mean, I think Barack Obama or a Democrat was going to win that campaign regardless of whether there was a liberal blogosphere or not. But it was interesting to see, again, the impact that they had. The amount of money that the Obama campaign was able to raise online, again, was just absolutely staggering, and no one had ever even dreamt of those kind of numbers online. And the way they were able to create their own social networking site and link up with supporters was also revolutionary. So in terms of, you know, sort of the raw electoral politics, I think 2006 was the watershed. In terms of the way campaigns are run, probably 2008 was a good indication of how the blogosphere and the Netroots was playing in with national politics.
In the book, Eric Bowler, you have a fairly long discussion, and a very interesting discussion, because I remember it well, and I think listeners of this program do too, of how into the first few months of 2008, the first half of 2008, really, the blogosphere got caught up in the contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination, and a significant percentage of the liberal progressive blogosphere went heavily to Obama. And only a small percentage was in the Clinton camp, and a tremendous amount of animosity emerged in this period. And you write about this period, and you write about it, if I detected your tone correctly, somewhat critical of the Obama supporters and sympathetic to the Clinton supporters. Can you explain your analysis?
This was the Civil War. It was known, and it's now sort of the topic that is not to be discussed, because I think it was so painful for so many bloggers and readers, and a lot of the bloggers themselves are still scarred from it. What's interesting is the blogosphere, liberal blogosphere, had never dealt anything like this. I mean, there had always been an obvious rallying around opposition to the war, opposition to the Bush administration. Clearly, when there was going to be a primary, everyone knew there was going to be a split. Some people would go with Edwards and Clinton and Obama. And 2007, we forget how long this campaign was, but it went all the way through 2007, all the way through 2008. But in 2007, that's pretty much how it played out. If you went to the Daily Coast poll, John Edwards had the most support, followed by Obama. Clinton, not much support at all. She was seen as a centrist. She was seen as sort of a part of the triangulating wing of the Democratic Party. But John Edwards was seen as by far sort of the more passionately progressive. And Barack Obama was viewed with a certain amount of suspicion for some of the comments he had made while campaigning extolling Ronald Reagan sort of famously early in 2008, not being as really as aggressive in terms of discussing health care and things like that. So 2007, it sort of played out the way people thought. There wasn't that much animosity. It was just sort of people discussing policies, trying to push all the candidates into a, in a progressive way and things like that. Then John Edwards got out of the race, and as I said in the book, sort of all hell broke loose, because now it was just Obama and Clinton, and it seemed to me, particularly at Daily Coast, that community thrives on having a villain, and Hillary Clinton almost overnight became the new George Bush. George Bush was, leaving the national stage, and suddenly Hillary Clinton became the target for what I thought was an extraordinary amount of animosity and sort of echoing right-wing talking points about Hillary Clinton. She couldn't be trusted, et cetera. And I think one of the low points came when the liberal blogosphere was following Matt Drudge on stories. If folks remember, he pushed the story. In 2008, he posted a photo of Obama when, as a senator, had taken a trip to Africa and had sort of traditional African garb. And Drudge posted the photo with one of his quote-unquote exclusives, claiming that the Clinton campaign was sending this photo around. And for years, the liberal blogosphere had been quite adamant and never taking Matt Drudge seriously, particularly when he had his own, quote, exclusives, which were almost universally never supported by any facts. but in this case, they did, and they sort of along with the mainstream press, spent the whole day, either condemning the Clinton campaign for supposedly sending the photo around, of which there was never any evidence that they did, or sort of trying to parse what it all meant, what the Clinton campaign was trying to say with this photo and things like that. And for a lot of bloggers who had been denouncing, Drudge for years, it was sort of disheartening to see a lot of the liberal blogosphere basically following Matt Drudge's lead.
Eric Bullard, I mean, as I listened to what you were saying and I read the section in the book, I couldn't help but think, and can't help but thinking now, that since Dennis Kucinich was marginalized from the get-go by everyone, including the blogosphere, as sort of dangerously or idiotically irrelevant to the race, and once John Edwards dropped out as the only sort of quasi or progressive voice who was taken seriously, there really, to my knowledge, was no difference between Obama and Clinton on virtually any issue. So if you're going to have a candidate, you're sort of forced to do nonsense stuff because there were no policy differences, were there?
Well, again, if you talk to some of the bloggers, some of them I talked to on the record, discussed this, some of them were just talked about it off the record because it was so disheartening. That's what, and I think Jane Hampshire and says it in my book, or Digby, saying they couldn't figure out where these runaway emotions were coming from in terms of Clinton and Obama, because they couldn't figure out what the difference was between them. I mean, to them and others, the difference in their policy was absolutely, marginal. And yet here, these camps and their supporters and even some bloggers were fighting it out as if these were, as if the difference between them was, black and white or opposite ends of the political spectrum. And I think the historic nature of the race played into that, and then there was a whole other chapter in the book where I talk about what the Clinton bloggers saw as sort of the runaway sexism, and obviously Obama supporters tagged the Clinton campaign for claims of being racist. So it all sort of went into the stew that became really just a nightmare for the blogosphere. And as I jokingly said, it's sort of the topic that can't be discussed, or is not to be discussed. Most people, I think, if you ask them privately, would concede looking back that it was sort of a low point for the blogosphere, and people said and did things that they, under any other circumstances, never would have, and aren't particularly proud of it now.
Why do you think someone like Dennis Kucinich, and I'm not meaning to carry water for Dennis Kucinich here, but someone like Kucinich, who I think it's fair to say, because I read the liberal blogosphere pretty religiously, on issue after issue is far closer to the political views of the core listener, readership and writership of the blogs than either Obama or Clinton. You know, basically, even before any primaries, I mean, long before they even actually voted, so there's no way you could say the guy was not relevant. Was sort of cast off into the Wendell Willkieville.
Electability. You know, I think the bloggers were pretty upfront. You know, they've always sort of, it's always been straddling a line, you know, between idealism and practicality, and they went through this during the Dean campaign a little bit. But I think in 2008, the idea was, this is ours for the taking. We can't blow this. We've got to get, we've got to win the White House. We've got to get as many Democrats as elected. And they were pretty clear about a certain pragmatism that was in play, and a lot of it was about electability. And a lot of them just did not see Kucinich as being electable in any way, even though, as you suggest, if you went down sort of policy by policy, some of that might be a better match for the blogosphere in general.
Our guest today, Eric Bollert. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Eric Bollert is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he writes a column and a blog. You can check him out there. He's also the author of the brand new book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, just released by Free Press. So if you'd like to call in to talk about this book, or talk about the work of Media Matters and the sort of media analysis Eric Bollert does on a regular basis. The number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Eric, in the book, you talk about the influence of the blogosphere over politics and how politicians take it seriously, and also how old media is taking it seriously, too. I mean, it's influencing the nature of political journalism and political discourse, campaign discourse. And in the example you talk about, one of them is, for example, the Rachel Maddow. And I think to a certain extent, Keith Olbermann fit the same profile, how a lot of what they do is teeing off on the blogosphere.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, and Rachel Maddow has described herself as sort of basically a blogger with a TV show. And what had been missing previously is...
And a paycheck.
Yeah, and a paycheck. What had been missing previously, A, if you go back to 2001, 2002, a lot of liberals and progressives didn't see or hear their opinions reflected really anywhere in the mainstream sort of corporate press. And then as the blogosphere began to grow, they were having their own progressive conversation online. They were creating sort of their own mass media. They were sort of hitting critical mass. But there was still sort of this gap between what was being said, you know, the conversation and the buzz on the blogosphere, and, you know, what the, quote, Democratic strategists were saying on MSNBC or CNN. It was still very sort of a corporate centrist view of the Democratic Party or progressive politics. And I think what Keith Olbermann first did, and then certainly Rachel Maddow has done with A Full Embrace, is the same thing that Arianna Huffington did with the Huffington Post, which was, we're going to take that conversation and we're going to put it right into the mainstream. We're going to put it on television. We're going to talk about what they're talking about. We're going to feature what they're featuring. So, and again, the right-wing media has had these liaisons for decades. I mean, obviously Fox News and talk radio and, you know, the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the Washington Times, I mean, they all faithfully, you know, pick up whatever, you know, sort of the right-wing blogosphere is talking about. The progressives have had much fewer willing takers in the past, and I think that's one of the reasons, that's what's so significant about what some of the MSNBC programs are doing now.
You know, what's striking about those programs as well, Eric Bollert, is both of them, and I'm thinking especially, though, of Olbermann, but it's really true of both, spend an inordinate amount of time responding to issues raised by the right. I mean, it seems like the right is still the agenda setter.
Yeah.
I mean, I rarely go to Fox News and see them responding to an investigative report from the Keith Olbermann show trying to, you know, cover up for some political or corporate interest. So it seems at a certain level that even from the so-called grave, the political right still controls the news agenda, what gets talked about, even by liberals and progressives.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think probably a lot of that is the spillover from the Bush years, because both those shows were created under the Bush years. So I think that sort of the normal starting point was, you know, what are conservatives saying about Bush? What are, you know, it's sort of knocking down conservative stuff when the Republicans controlled the White House and Congress and things like that. And I see your point. I hadn't really thought about it, but I still think there's an awful lot of that going on. I think part of that is just since Obama's inauguration. I mean, the unhinged response from the right-wing media caught a lot of people off guard, and to this day catches people off guard. I mean, there's no end in sight in terms of, you know, sort of heading off the cliff. So I think, you know, both in the blogosphere and on some of the TV shows, I think there's a sense that they have to play defense, and they're probably playing a lot more defense than they want to or thought they would, but the response has just been so astonishing and unhinged that it's important to try to knock some of that stuff down. And so, I think they do, both communities probably do spend more time than conservatives did when Republicans were in office, for instance.
One of the things I've noticed, Jarek Bolert, reading some of the webs, the bloggers, liberal blogosphere, and here I'm thinking perhaps a little more out on the sort of open left edge of the liberal blogosphere, it's been almost, I wouldn't say buyer's remorse, because I don't think they were necessarily big Obama fans to begin with, although they were certainly Obama supporters.
Yeah.
But a sense that despite all the work of the people working hard in the blogosphere to try to shift American politics in a more progressive direction.
Yeah.
What we have with the Obama administration on foreign policy, on relations with Wall Street, on employee free choice, on health care, on issue after issue where big money is involved, an administration that's not really in any way to be distinguished from the sort of conservative mainstream business Democrats we've had over the last three decades.
Right, the sort of the Clinton triangulating.
Yeah, and I mean, how, in a way, that sort of, I think, is leading among certain bloggers to sort of a self-appraisal. Maybe we are pretty irrelevant still, or maybe we haven't been that successful.
Right, no, absolutely. There, you know, and I talk at the end of the book about this, a certain frustration. I mean, when it became apparent that, you know, Obama was certainly going to win the election, there was this frustration because I say in the book, Obama clearly won over the internet, but he and his campaign had almost no interest in the blogosphere. As a candidate, he was fairly upfront that he just was not really comfortable with that passionate partisan rhetoric of the liberal blogosphere, whose really number one mantra was the Democrats had to be partisan fighters, and the only way to change politics in Washington was to beat back the Republican attacks. And Obama did not run as that kind of candidate. He did not have sort of that Howard Dean or Al Gore fire within. So, you know, when it became, I think the bloggers and a lot of progressives, knowing that 2008 was almost definitely going to be a Democratic victory, they had sort of these visions of crossing the finish line in November hand in hand with the winning candidate. But it didn't really work out that way. Obama and the grassroots movement he created and his campaign created, it separate and independent of the blogosphere, crossed the finish line, and then sort of 20 yards behind, the bloggers also came across the finish line. So there was definitely a frustration. The Obama campaign never really did any, for most of 2008, did very little serious outreach to the blogosphere. But then, as you mentioned, the blogosphere really did essentially send its entire support to the Obama campaign, which left some people, and I know Matt Stoller and I think Chris Bowers have probably written about this at Open Left, wondering, you know, did we just give away all our leverage? Did we give all our support to a candidate in response for nothing in return? did we have anything to show from the Obama campaign for all of our support? Glenn Greenwald has also written about this. Because, again, through 2007, the whole idea was we're going to support the candidate that is most responsive to us and really echoes the priorities of the liberal blogosphere. And again, Obama, as a candidate, was pretty open that that wasn't him, yet he did win the overwhelming support of the blogosphere. I think some people are looking back wondering, you know, was that the smartest thing? What could we have done differently? Because, as you mentioned, there are issues now that are in play that a lot of folks on the left have a sense of frustration in terms of not that much different, or not as much different as they had hoped with a Democratic victory.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. You've just been listening to Eric Bollert, the author of the brand new book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, right here at WILL AM 580. The number here, if you'd like to call in, is 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Eric Bollert is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he blogs and writes columns and reports on media today and the way media cover politics. We'll get into some of those issues in the second half of the show. Let's go to the phone lines first, though. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Eric Bollert.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for the show. It was very interesting. I have two quick comments. One is that one of my favorite liberal blogs is Talking Points Memo and Josh Marshall. And I thought he did a lovely job all through the campaign and did a pretty reasonable job of issues related to both the Republicans and the Democrats. The second question I have is I've been reflecting lately about, or the second point I have is some reflections I've been doing lately about the polarization of media and the way in which things have changed. I was born in the late 50s, and I remember as I was coming up, this may be just a convenient memory, but my sense is that there was a more even-handed attempt at describing stories back in the 70s or 80s. And now that we've got such ability to segment these markets so that Fox can go after the certain segment and MSNBC can go after a certain segment, that things have become more and more extreme. And I wonder if that's not contributing to some of the, you know, like the Tea Party stuff and that ridiculous march in Washington that happened last week, and the kind of divisiveness and ugliness that we're seeing today. So those are my comments, and I'd like to hear you respond. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And I should add for listeners who don't go to the Media Matters website, where Eric Bollert writes, he's written on all these issues at length in recent weeks. So go to the Media Matters for America website, and you get the detailed answers. And now, Eric, you can give us the short answers.
Yeah, the first point, Talking Points Memo, that's a good point. That's definitely one of the anchors of the Netroots movement. I think talk about someone who can make money doing it. Josh is one. I think I saw a headline last week where he's going to soon have a staff of 40 or 50 reporters. So that has certainly been a success story. In terms of the polarization, that sort of segues into the whole Fox News phenomena of 2009. I think it's essentially coming from the right wing. I think MSNBC during the day essentially does news. We critique it all the time for what we see is, you know, occasional bouts of conservative misinformation. They have opinionated shows at night, but I don't see MSNBC. I know the mainstream press, and they do it all the time. George Stephanopoulos did it on this week, on Sunday morning today, talking about, well, gee, you know, I flip from MSNBC and Fox News, and everyone seems so angry. I don't see any comparison to what MSNBC and Fox News is doing. I think Fox News is completely driving this purposeful polarization, and they have completely transformed themselves from a news organization into the opposition party of the Obama White House, and they have really sort of severed whatever remaining ties they had with journalism and have turned themselves into a purely partisan and political operation 24/7.
It's now, Eric, if I can interject, because I think one of the things in your writing you do that really illuminates this point is you discuss the sort of double standard that exists, that right-wing claims or hosts made on Fox make claims, ludicrous claims, that, you know, were a so-called liberal or mainstream person to make a similarly dubious claim, they'd be run out of the profession.
Yes.
Can you give one or two examples of things like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, just if talking about the protest in Washington last week, the rally that the caller mentioned, Glenn Beck went on the air Monday and said there was 1.7 million people there. I detailed how all last weekend the right-wing blogosphere, led by Michelle Malkin, were claiming there were 2 million people in Washington. I mean, just even if you didn't even turn on the TV and looked at the size of the crowd, if you understand what 2 million people in Washington, the city of Washington, means, it's essentially the same as the Obama inauguration. You couldn't get a hotel from Richmond to Trenton during the Obama inauguration. Metro stations were closed entirely. I mean, it was basically functioning chaos for 24 hours. Last weekend was nowhere even close to that. The fire department in Washington put the crowd at 60,000. So we have the conservative right-wing claims of a protest that were off by about 1.9 million people. That's sort of significant, but the point that you made in terms of wild, outlandish, demonstrably false claims and how the mainstream press doesn't hold them accountable, this week Glenn Beck is on the cover of Time magazine, and they actually talk about the size of the crowds, and they don't point out that Glenn Beck lied through his teeth when he claimed there were 1.7 million people there. If anti-war protesters in 2003, who actually got about, in 2004, actually got at least a quarter of a million people in Washington, if they had increased their size, the crowd of the size by 30, if they had claimed, what is that, 5 million people were in Washington, I think the mainstream press would have essentially, as you said, run them out of town and tagged them as fools and purposeful idiots.
Or to turn it around, if Keith Olbermann had said in his show that the turnout at the teabagger demonstration had been 250 people,
right.
You know, George Stephanopoulos would say this guy's a complete idiot.
Yeah, he can't even open his eyes. What's wrong? I mean, his partisan has blinded him to the facts. But, you know, the press rarely holds the right-wing media accountable for anything, for any of the falsehoods that they make up. So that to me is sort of a perfect example of how they really, you know, sort of lie with impunity.
One of the things you do in your work for Media Matters for America, Eric Bollard, is you write about these various personalities, and I know many of our listeners are familiar with the people who are sort of setting the discourse now over at Fox and on talk radio, but they don't probably listen or watch them very often, I'm willing to hazard a guess. And I'm talking, and including CNN's Lou Dobbs, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Savage, O'Reilly. Are these guys, for the sake of listeners who might not be personally fans or devotees of the programs or have much experience with them, are they all pretty much of the same mix, saying the same stuff, or do they have staked out different turfs?
Well, it's interesting. O'Reilly has really sort of has now seen as sort of the wise man of the right-wing media. I mean, it's sort of sad, but if you had to compare him with the others, he has a show that expresses some semblance of common sense from time to time. I don't think he's really moved. I think everyone else has just, you know, rushed past him to the far right fringes. So yeah, I think Limbaugh, Beck, Michael Savage, those three to me are the most hateful, incendiary, just raw, paranoid, just really vile stuff. I think Sean Hannity is sort of sticks to politics in a way. Just pure GOP talking points all night, RNC for 60 minutes. But Beck and Limbaugh and Savage are really driving the idea that Obama isn't one of us. He's foreign, he's dangerous, he's shady, he's a communist. he's really, their message, he's destroying America on purpose. I think that really captures the whole ethos for 2009. He's destroying America, and he's doing it on purpose, and somebody needs to stop this guy. We've never really had a political movement in America that's rallied around that kind of message, and certainly not a movement that's formed, that was formed 3 or 4 months into the president's first term.
And not to belabor the double standard question, but if I'm not mistaken, 3 or 4 years ago, MoveOn.org, the Move On people, had some sort of contest where people could send in their TV ads opposing the Bush administration. And one of the ones that was sent in compared Bush to Hitler.
Right.
And it was a huge outcry. How dare anyone do that? And MoveOn said, we had nothing to do with this. We apologize. We're not going to let this guy ever, you know, eat lunch with us or anything in the future. He's terrible. This is awful. And the mainstream media, as I recall, leapt all over this. I think maybe Congress even had a resolution about it, that sort of thing.
It was, yeah, it was a story for a week. I went back and I looked at the coverage a couple of weeks ago because, of course, the obvious double standard is, and it's interesting, the conservative media, National Review in particular, was obsessive during the Bush years in terms of detailing, you know, any liberal protesters or columnists or talk show hosts, anyone who dared, you know, mention swastikas or Hitler under Bush, because that was obvious proof you were unserious, that you were deranged. Who would compare the president to Adolf Hitler? And, of course, now Glenn Beck sort of does it every night. Rush Limbaugh is, you know, the most listened to talk show host in America, has openly talked about you know, the administration reminds him of a Nazi organization. And suddenly, you know, the folks at National Review aren't that interested in detailing, you know, people who use the Hitler analogy. But you're right, the talk, and it's interesting, and Beck and Limbaugh have not only refused to apologize, they continue, you know, using the Hitler rhetoric. But your point about Move On, that was a, you know, a user-generated contest, 1,500 submissions, and one or two of them were hosted on their site that actually had Hitler imagery. And as you said, I mean, Move On quickly denounced it and apologized. But that was a story then, because that showed, supposedly told us, how deranged the liberal movement in America was, despite the fact that, A, no one proved it, and they apologized, and they took it down, and all that stuff. And today you have a conservative movement in the country which is sort of wallowing in this Hitler stuff. But apparently that doesn't tell us anything about the conservative movement in America. As you said, it's a rather obvious double standard.
What does it say about our journalism today, our mainstream journalism, Eric Bollert, that, you know, because Fox is now regarded as the voice of the Republican Party, or in many ways, that it, when its correspondents say something and Republican politicians say it either simultaneously or sequentially, birther sort of stuff, or any of these sort of grandma getting killed, the list goes on and on, Acorn being awful. But it becomes a major news story that, you know, even when journalists know that these are absurd stories, they're published and run in such ways, they're regarded credibly for what does it say about our journalistic practices that we don't have a journalism that can say something's not true when it's not true?
Yeah, the problem is with Fox News becoming the opposition party, it's interesting. Both last week I noticed the Washington Post and the New York Times did stories, I think one was Acorn, one was Czar related. This was Acorn before the House voted the way it did. But basically the premise was conservatives attack Obama over XYZ, fill in the blank. And the lead was always, you know, conservative commentators or Fox News are pressing this point. Well, in the past that was never considered news inside the Beltway. I mean, if the opposition, if the minority party, if politicians were making allegations that were deemed sufficiently serious by the press, they would be reported on. But the idea that during the Bush years the press ever wrote stories, you know, Air America is complaining about XYZ, it was a joke. I mean, they would never do that.
Yeah.
But now we have entire news models. Politico does this all the time, where it's basically whatever conservative commentators are saying. Let's face it, Republican politicians in Washington are essentially irrelevant. They have no legislative power whatsoever. Nobody cares what John Bonier or Mitch McConnell have to say. So now the news model is, if Fox News or Rush Limbaugh is saying something, it must be important and it must be newsworthy. Again, that's a totally new standard for political reporting. That was never the way the opposition voice was dealt with during the Bush years. And then the other problem, as you stated, is A, they're legitimizing these sort of, you know, smear of the day as news. And then when they do, they're not calling it out as sort of the BS that it is. I'm thinking about when, conservatives were claiming that Obama was going to indoctrinate school kids when he spoke, made his national address. That charge was made based on nothing. I mean, the conservatives who made that charge literally had no idea what Obama was going to say in school. They just concocted this idea that he was going to push some sort of radical socialist agenda. And so the press over the weekend reported it as news, and then finally, days later, they also reported, oh, by the way, there was nothing to that claim. Obama basically urged students to excel and stay in school. I think they probably knew that like 3 days before, but they were just, they're intimidated by the right wing and the whole liberal media charge, and B, they're overly impressed by Republican hardball, and they have been for years.
Do you think the Obama administration has done an effective or intelligent job of responding to the way the political right and Fox has been sort of constantly throwing mud balls at them?
It's tough. I thought it was smart to keep Obama off of Fox News this weekend, even after he did every other news show. I think that sends a message that Fox is not really a news organization, and it's true. I think there's a lot of second guessing, certainly in the Beltway press, like the health care mini mobs this summer. I saw a lot of mentions of pundits. Well, the White House should have seen that coming. And half of me says, well, I guess they were a little slow responding just in terms of a media game. But then half of me says, why would you have possibly seen this coming? When else have people shown up with loaded guns and swastikas and complaining the president wasn't born in America? I mean, there's no precedent for this in modern American politics. Why? And they even said that about the school speech. Well, the White House should have seen it coming. Why would they have suspected that an innocuous speech about staying in school would ignite a controversy about a socialist agenda? I think that's being lazy and saying the White House. I don't know how you predict sort of these increasingly irrational and unhinged sort of mud balls and smear campaigns.
Our guest is Eric Bollert, author of the brand new book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, just out by Free Press. He also is a senior fellow at the Media Matters for America, where you can find his writings on contemporary politics and media issues. Let's go back to the phone lines for a final caller. Caller one, Urbana, you're on the air with Eric Bollert.
Hello. I heard Mr. Stephanopoulos this morning bloviating about MSNBC and Fox. I guess he's trying to shoot for ratings. He wants to be Mr. Middle of the Road, which ABC is not, or either is he. But surely this week the big story was Israel found guilty of war crimes, at least allegedly, by the UN, and this story was mentioned. And the only thing we really got from NPR was an interview with the war criminals, which, of course, they said they did not do it. Your comments, please. Thank you.
Well, I mean, this is the problem when politics and media gets obsessed with sort of these process, trivial stories. Even if you look at the healthcare debate, there's been very little coverage about healthcare in this country. Most of the summer, it was a processed and politics story. And this is an example of everything that gets lost while we do these sort of absurd either right-wing attack stories or process in politics, which is, you know, the press loses interest in actual hard news and foreign affairs and things that it might be of interest to the general public. So I think that's part of it, and frankly, right now, I don't think, outside of Afghanistan, I don't think any of the major news organizations are paying attention to any foreign coverage whatsoever, let alone news of war crimes from the Middle East. So unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me that stories like that get lost, but I can see why.
Yeah, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Eric Bollert, and I do want you to talk, if you would, a little bit about this whole Acorn episode of last week and what that all means. And let me preface it just by saying that this group Acorn that is being attacked, they must be doing something right to have so many people hate them.
Well, it's interesting in that, you know, I'll say at the beginning, I think what almost everyone does, which is the behavior of the Acorn staffers is, I think the CEO has described it as indefensible, and other people have described it as, you know, foolish and depressing and all those things. So that's all out on the table. But what's interesting is if you look at this from a journalism perspective, this did not spring from a vacuum, as you say. Acorn has been the center of a right-wing obsession, a jihad, and Fox News has been out front leading it for at least the last year. If you go back to last fall, just in the closing weeks of the campaign, Fox was just all Acorn all the time. People forget it now. 1,500 mentions is what Fox gave to Acorn in October and early November last year. The irony was they didn't, and their whole point then was voter fraud. You know, Acorn was just supposedly, you know, pushing through millions of fraudulent voter registration forms. If you go back and look, they didn't budge that story an inch. They didn't break any news whatsoever. It was just sort of fear-mongering. So now with these videos, it's part of this crusade. And the other interesting thing I would say about that is, you know, airing raw video is not journalism. You know, a lot of the conservative critics would say, well, 60 Minutes should have done this story, or you know, the network should have been all over this story. It shouldn't have been left to these, you know, young activists. Well, if 60 Minutes had done this story and found the same sort of irresponsible behavior of Acorn staffers, the 60 Minutes report wouldn't have been simply running unedited video. You do reporting, and you add context, and you interview people. You allow Acorn to respond before the tapes are aired. Fox did nothing, none of this, because I don't really think Fox knows how to do journalism anymore. But so my point is, you know, just airing unedited video, that doesn't really qualify as journalism. And also then Fox News sort of was guilty of sorting, trying to improve the story on a couple of times. And also CNN did do some actual reporting and showed and reported that, you know, these undercover people went to the Philadelphia office of Acorn and were essentially shown the door, and the Acorn staffers thought their pitch was so bizarre they actually filled out a police report.
On that note, unfortunately, Eric Bollert, I hear the band tuning up the background. They want to get me out of the studio. Eric Bollert, author of the brand new book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
I'll talk to you soon.
I want to thank Kyle Crowhoff for working the board and my producer, Melissa Trench, for great work. I'm Bob McChesney, and everyone, I'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana calls for a chance of measurable snow this afternoon, a high of 34 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies and a 40% chance of snow, a low of 25. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 31. And tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of snow, a low of 25. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.